This presentation by Eugene Fama, titled Perspectives on Financial Research, was recorded on 9 May 2012 at the 65th CFA Institute Annual Conference.
I'd like to introduce you to Gene Fama. It's my honor, really, to be here. Gene is the Robert R. McCormick Professor of Finance at the University of Chicago, Booth School of Business. And Gene, you are, I'm just going to quote Dick Roll here now, you are probably the most widely cited finance professor ever. You've been at the University of Chicago, I think, for over 50 years, helping to develop the theory of finance. Now, you and I just met a few minutes ago for the first time backstage, and we have an hour here to get acquainted in front of a few thousand investment professionals who I'm sure would like to get to know you better. So, in order to start off and frame the discussion, let me try and explain in my words why I think your contribution is so profound, and you just correct me if I get it wrong, all right? I would say there's two intertwining concepts at the center of finance, equilibrium theory and market efficiency. And I would include rational expectations as part of market efficiency. And Gene, you've been at the center of the development of these powerful ideas. And at the heart of your contribution, as I understand it, is to have realized early on how intricately these ideas are intertwined. Is that fair?
That's the whole story.
Okay. Well, good. I guess I passed. I think this audience, which has studied the CFA curriculum, appreciates what a profound impact these ideas have had on finance, on the development of markets, on really wealth creation in the world in the last 50 years. So let's get started. Since I haven't met you, I did a little bit of research, and one of the things I discovered that I thought was very interesting is that in addition to your intellectual achievements, you actually are quite an athlete. That
I was.
You were, okay. Well, many people don't know this, but Gene was a member of the Malden Catholic High School Athletic Hall of Fame, having played, what is it, football, basketball, baseball, and
correct.
Track? Yeah. And today you are still playing tennis?
No.
No?
Golf?
Golf, all right. And windsurfing?
You were, yes.
And windsurfing,
yes.
Okay. Pretty good. Let me start by asking you, how did you go from being a jock at Malden Catholic High School to the University of Chicago?
Well, I knew right away that I didn't want to work for a living. So,
okay.
I started working when I was 14 years old, and the experiences taught me that it was better to get a good education, and that if I went into academics, it wouldn't interfere with my athletic pursuits. And that's worked out quite well, actually.
you make it sound like you're not a hard worker. I understand you have a pretty strong work ethic.
Well, I work a lot, but the advantage of academics is that you work when you want to. So I work 7 days a week, but when I want to go play, I go play.
Okay. Why Chicago? What made you...
You want to hear that story?
I think it's an interesting story.
Okay, so I was an undergraduate at Tufts. In economics and thinking about graduate schools, thinking about business schools, and I had been, you know, talking to my professors. They were all from Harvard. They told me, don't go to Harvard. Go to Chicago. That's the place where the business school has some academic orientation that would be more suitable for your particular interest and tastes. So I was I applied to Chicago. And April came along, and May 1st came along, and I hadn't heard anything. So I called. The school was much smaller in those days, and the dean of students answered. And he looked, and he said, oh, we don't have any record of your application. So he said, what school are you from? And I said, Tufts. He said, what kind of grades have you got? And I told him, pretty good. And he said, okay, we happen to have a scholarship for somebody from Tufts here. Do you want it?
Over the phone.
Right.
He just gave it to you.
Right.
Pretty good talker.
That's serendipity.
Okay, well, let's jump right in. And can you explain, in your own words, why market efficiency and equilibrium are such important concepts?
Well, Market efficiency is basically, it is the basis of capitalism. Capitalism is based on the proposition that markets work, basically. And market efficiency is the proposition that markets do work. Prices reflect available information. Now, the way this joins up with the notion of equilibrium is it's easy to say prices reflect all available information. But then if you want to test that, you have to have some story about what the market's trying to do in setting prices. And that's where a model of market equilibrium comes along. So basically, you need a risk-return story to test market efficiency. But the reverse is also true. Almost all asset pricing models that I know of are based, assume that markets are efficient. So some people talk about testing asset pricing models. Some people talk about testing market efficiency. But they're always basically jointly testing a proposition about equilibrium along with market efficiency, and the two can never really be separated.
Mm-hmm. And in the development of this idea or these ideas through time, were there particular points where things surprised you? I mean, it was sort of, oh, the light went on, kind of, so to speak.
Well, I have to go back. I'll give you a little there is a point. So when I was an undergraduate, I worked for, believe it or not, a stock market forecasting service, where my job was to devise mechanical trading rules that worked. And the rules I devised always worked on past returns. They never worked on the holdout sample.
So technical trading rules.
Right.
Yeah.
So finally, after 2 years of graduate school, finishing all the courses and everything, and I started talking to Merton Miller and Lester Telser and those people, and they were kind of thrashing around with this idea of what would prices look like if the market's working properly. And that's how I got into it. It was something everybody was interested in. It was easy to get people to supervise you. And I had some data, which could be used to write a thesis, which is what I did.
Yeah, data and computers were kind of new things in those days.
Totally new. I was the first computer user in, at least at the University of Chicago, in economics out of the business school. When they first put in the original 7090 IBM, it was me and a fellow from the physics department that would be there all night long feeding stuff into this thing. And I would call IBM and say, there's something wrong with your compiler. And they would laugh.
And there was?
And there was. So after about three or four times, they didn't laugh anymore.
So what part was where the light went on?
Oh, the light went on when I started working with Merton and other people. Benoit Mandelbrot as well. It was a frequent visitor to Chicago. The light went on when it dawned on me that the reason my undergraduate stuff didn't work out of sample was because price changes were pretty random, which was at that point what people thought an efficient market meant. It doesn't, not, we know now it doesn't, but.
Mm-hmm. Who was the first person to sort of point that out?
Point out?
That randomness wasn't efficiency.
I think that's when I put in the model of market equilibrium, because then there can be some predictability in returns. If the model of market equilibrium has expected returns, it follows some predictable pattern.
So the risk premium,
right.
Maybe. Yeah, okay, very good. Now, I don't know if you realize this, but you and I share one rather unique experience in common. Apparently, both of us had the opportunity of having an office
right
next to Fisher Black,
right.
Who was, you know, a very brilliant guy, a very
Indeed. Idiosyncratic
guy.
Right.
I wonder if you have any experiences or memories that you might share with
us. Oh, sure. Fisher played tennis with my wife all the time, and whenever she said something about family or anything, you knew Fisher very well, he'd take out his notebook and
write down.
Where should I go for vacation? He'd take out his notebook and write it down. But his office was opposite to mine. We both came in very early in the morning. And this was at the time when tests of the capital asset pricing model were first being done. And he and Myron and Mike Jensen were suspicious of the test that had been done because it looked like the standard errors of the measured slope, the measured market premium were too low, relative to what they knew the volatility of stock returns were. And so Fisher devised this elaborate technique for forming portfolios that would capture the premium and would allow for, the basic problem is the cross-correlation of returns, would allow for the cross-correlation of returns. And he showed it to me, and I said, "That's great, Fisher. You just discovered regression." And he said, no, I didn't. And I said, yes, you did. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. So finally, I wrote what became Chapter 8 of my textbook, showing him that what the portfolio interpretation of a regression is. And that became pretty standard thereafter.
That was
But Fisher was the only other person that John Cochrane is somewhat like that, too. But they're very rare, even in academics, as somebody who can cause you to think entirely differently about something you've been working on. Whether they're right or wrong, they're going to cause you to think about it differently. And it's hard to think of anything that's more valuable than that when you're doing research, because, just to tell you another story, I went away to Belgium for 2 years, and I wrote a ton of papers, and I brought them back, and I showed them to Merton Miller, and he said, "Garbage, garbage, garbage. Okay, garbage, garbage, garbage." He was right on every one of them. But that's the problem of working in a vacuum without colleagues to keep putting you back on the right track. You'll waste a lot of time.
Yeah, it's interesting.
You don't have them.
It's interesting you say that about Fisher. I had exactly the same experience. Yeah, exactly. So let's turn now to more recent events. In particular, we're all, suffering from the after effects of the financial crisis. What do you think caused that, and what are the lessons we should take away from it?
Well, I take a somewhat contrary view of that. I don't think it was particularly a financial disaster that caused an economic disaster. I think you can't reject the hypothesis that it was an economic disaster that caused the financial disaster. Now, I think lots of crazy things were done. I don't think it was a problem with markets. I think it was a problem mostly with political pressures on people about financing, second-rate mortgages and things like that. But basically, I think it all came tumbling down because a huge recession came along. Now, maybe the financial crisis accentuated that, but it's hard to think that if there wasn't a pretty significant recession, the financial system would have come crashing down. So that's a position that very few other people take. I take it, and people treat me like a fool, but I'm used to that.
Well, I tell you, I was there on Wall Street in late 2006, and a hedge fund manager came up to me and said, "Bob, do you think subprime is going to take down the economy?" And I didn't know what he was talking about.
Right.
But from inside, it sure felt that way. It sure...
Well, in fact, it wasn't big enough to really...
Well, that's what people said.
Right.
Yeah, but then some people sort of have this insight.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe,
Well, but then it becomes difficult to say, why was this spread around the world? Because subprime was basically a U.S. phenomenon.
Yeah, well...
Other people were holding it. Yeah. Right, other people were holding it. But, we've had financial institutions go bust in the past because they made dumb decisions. The worst thing to come out of that experience, in my view, is too big to fail. That has messed up the financial system to no end.
I totally agree. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, basically now the institutions that are too big to fail have their debt priced as if it's riskless, which gives them a low cost of capital, which is going to make it very easy for them to expand and then become an even bigger problem. Plus, everybody accepts now that they're too big to fail. That's a terrible moral hazard position for people to be in. They won't consciously tank their companies, but it's nevertheless going to push them in the direction of taking more risk, whether they know it or not. So I don't think Dodd-Frank cures any of this. The problem is, even if you could devise perfect regulation for all of this, the chance that it will be implemented by the regulators that you put in place is pretty close to zero. So I think the simplest regulation would be to just jack up the capital requirements. Mm-hmm. I think like 25% is a nice number to start with. If that doesn't work, we'll go higher. But basically, you need to push the capital ratio high enough so that the debt is in fact riskless, because the capital ratio, because the equity ratio is high, not because it has a guarantee from the government.
A lot of these financial institutions, the big ones, and the government are struggling to fill out the details of Dodd-Frank.
Right.
And boy, what a mess it seems to be. The Volcker rule, the attempt to move risk-taking away from those, what do you think that'll be successful?
Well, you were there. they didn't just bail out the commercial banks. They bailed out the investment banks.
Indeed.
And those were... So that's where the trading was mostly taking place. So if they move that off the books of the commercial banks, don't let them do it, they're still going to say that the people doing the trading are too big to fail. So I don't see that that will accomplish much.
Mm-hmm. So are there any other regulations or, you know, for instance, one of the outcomes seems to be the SEC is pushing much harder on insider trading. Do you think that's going to be helpful?
They've never been good at that.
You're not very optimistic.
No.
Let me ask you about another issue. A large fraction of state and local pension plans these days are significantly underfunded. How did that get to be the case, and what are the implications, and what should be done?
Well, it got to be the case because they didn't put in enough money into these plans, but the reality is that what they say their liabilities are about a third of what their actual liabilities are. The way that happens is they discount the stream of liabilities at what they take to be the expected return on the assets. Now, any economist person in finance looks at that and says, that's crazy. You discount the liabilities at the risk of the liabilities, not the assets. Now, the liabilities are basically indexed claims. So they're like a TIPS. So the appropriate discount rate on the high side would be like 2.5%, not the 7 or 8 that they use. If you use even 3%, you're going to triple their liabilities. Now, what does that mean? They're betting that good equity market returns, good risk market returns will bail them out. The problem is, you know for sure that over the life of these plans, there are going to be multiple bad markets, and they have to make their payments in those markets as well as in the good markets, and that's where the risk comes in. So these state and local pension funds are basically giant hedge funds. if that makes you uncomfortable, you should be.
So what's the solution?
You know, Fisher, going back to Fisher, said that these defined benefit plans should always be financed with debt, so that you would be able to match the liabilities and the assets. You could go back to that, but then they would have to lower their discount rates, and then it would be obvious that they're so far underfunded that these things are basically bust. I mean, I think the crisis the country faces is, down the line, some big state is going to go bust because of its pensions. And what will they do? State constitutions typically say they have to pay the bonds, and they have to pay the pensions, and then services come after that. Will that really be enforced when it comes right down to it? But so contracting is also going to be put under pressure at that point. The whole system will be put under pressure. Will Texas bail out California? I don't think so.
You think they might come to the U.S. government?
They will, indeed.
All right. You know, I've spent a lot of my career in the active management industry. Your work on market efficiency is certainly a bit of a challenge to those who try to try to mine alpha.
Right.
Now, I certainly don't think it's easy.
No.
And I think there's zero net supply in the market as a whole, right?
Okay. And I mean, that's a concept that I hope everybody understands, that active management in aggregate is a zero-sum game.
Yeah. I agree with
that. The
good
ones have to eat the bad ones because it has to add up to zero. Relative to their benchmarks, the active industry as a whole has to have zero alpha.
Right. And you've done some recent work.
Right.
It seems to show that some mutual fund managers systematically take alpha from other managers.
Yes.
Right. You had in a recent paper, you had this nice graph that showed if it was all luck, what it would look like, and then there's kind of tails on both ends.
Right. Now that's before costs.
Before costs, right?
If you give them back their costs, they look just like you would expect all active managers. Now mutual funds aren't all active managers. You've got hedge funds and everything else. But when you put them all the mutual funds together, there's a right tail and there's a left tail, and they just about balance each other off.
So what do you think is going on there? Who's making money from whom, and how is that working?
I don't know.
Oh. Okay.
Well, you know, they're predominantly stock pickers. So anytime, and this holds at the level of individual stocks as well, anytime you make money because you choose an individual stock, somebody else sold you that stock. So they're losing money. And you add those two up and they net out. But I think the part of that that's important for this audience, they won't believe it, but the part of it that's important is when you put the cost back in, only 3%, the top 3% of the managers produce returns that indicate that they have sufficient skill to cover their costs, just sufficient to cover their costs, which means that going forward, you expect them to be about as good as a low-cost passive index fund. Now, the part of that that's difficult to swallow is that this 3%, those are the people that books are written about. Their returns relative to their benchmarks have been, over their entire lifetimes, 3 to 6% higher than the benchmark returns, which is an incredible feat. The problem is, it's not a feat. The problem is, when you take 3,000 or 4,000 funds and look at all of them together, you expect the top 3% to look that good. So that's the luck versus skill part of this. Which means the other 97% you're expecting to do worse than.
Yeah, so you have to be pretty good at picking a manager just to.
Well, see, that's one conclusion you can draw. The other conclusion you can draw is you don't have a hope of picking the managers who are going to be good. Because you're going to base it. Think about what these services do. They show you 5, 10 years of past returns. 5 or 10 years of past returns is garbage. Yeah. It's basically noise. 35 years of past returns is what you need to conclude that the equity premium is reliably positive. Basically an investment lifetime. Yeah. Shorter than that, you don't have enough data to even say that the expected return on stocks is higher than the expected returns on bills.
Well, that's a good transition. Let me ask you about the equity risk premium.
Okay, good.
It seems, awfully high. At least that's been a puzzle that economists have talked about for 2 or 3 decades now.
Right.
Why is it so high? Do you have a thought about that?
Well, the macroeconomists have a problem with the observed equity premium because their models, their consumption-based models, predict that the premium should be a number between 0.5% and at the high end maybe 1.5%. And then you observe a number around 5%. Which seems, even over a long, full period of the CRSP data, it's more like 7%. Now, I think the 7% is too high in the sense that what's happened over the period of the CRSP data is that price-earnings ratios have gone up.
Yeah.
This basically started in the early 80s. Until then, the price-earnings ratio looked pretty stationary. But then it started going up. Now, Ken French and I wrote another paper that says, there are two things that could be going on here. Either expected future profitability is very high, or the discount rate, expected return on stocks, has gone down. Then we said we can't find any evidence that anybody can predict earnings, so not into the indefinite future anyway. So it can't be that. It must be that the discount rate has fallen, which means going forward, expected returns on stocks would be lower. So I think a good number is maybe 4%.
4%.
Now, that still bothers the economists.
Oh, yeah.
But my question to them always is, who do you know that would hold stocks if the premium were 1%?
Yeah.
I don't know anybody.
Yeah. Well, does that mean people are irrational?
No. I think it means that they have bad models.
Or too short a horizon?
No. Well, I don't know about that. But basically, there's something about their models that produces this result that doesn't conform to anybody's intuition about people's attitudes towards what's risky and what isn't.
Well, it's really the difference between the equity risk premium
of the consumption stream,
and
the
smoothness of the consumption stream and low real interest rates, right?
Right.
That's a bit of a puzzle these days,
that too,
isn't
right.
it?
Well, don't get me going on that one, but
sounds like a good thing to get you going.
Okay. So I'm trying to write a paper now that says the Fed does nothing, basically. Interest rates are what they are. They can change interest rates by changing expected inflation, but they can't affect the real rate at all.
But the real rate on tips now is...
It's negative.
Negative for 10 years.
The real rate on all
riskless
securities is negative.
Does that make sense?
Well, it's happened before. It was systematically negative, and it's predictably negative on short stuff because you know the rates are highly autocorrelated. It was in the 70s, a long period of time. Then in the 80s and 90s, in the 80s at least, we had high real returns, expected real returns for a long time. Now they've been low for about 10 years.
Yeah.
How this happens, I mean, it has to come down to savings and investment, right? That's the ultimate arbiter of all real rates. So it says there's a glut of savings, and at least in the world as a whole, if not in the U.S.
Right. I put $105 down in order to get $100
back
in 10 years. Amazing why people want to save so much, isn't it? Now, you've made clear that market efficiency doesn't imply that these risk premia are constant through time. They vary.
Right.
Have you seen evidence? I mean, you just mentioned some in the equity market. More generally, is there evidence that risk premia vary through time?
Well, for the equity market, there's a ton of work looking at the predictability of the market premium, the equity premium. And the results are basically that there seems to be predictability there, but it's statistically kind of flimsy. So there's a lot of arguments about biases in these tests. And there's some people who don't think it's... Everybody would agree that it has to be varying through time. This is the price, right? Prices are going to vary through time. It's a price of bearing risk. That's going to vary through time. What the problem or the disagreement is that we don't know how to capture that. The variables that we have may not be very good at capturing that. So that every year there are four or five papers. The problem is that you can't separate the expected return from the expected growth rate of future profits. So every year there are four or five papers that try to do that. Nobody's done it convincingly yet.
Okay, let's go to your three-factor model.
Okay.
What was it, 1992? With Ken French.
Right.
Up until then, you seemed to be a very staunch supporter of the CAPM.
Right.
And then you came out with this paper. You said it doesn't work.
Right.
What changed your mind?
Well, you're asking very good questions. They allow me to really give some perspective on this. So,
By the way, I got these questions from your students.
Okay, good. Good. Well, in 1992, what had happened was, you know, the CAPM was around since 1964 or 5, and then tests of it started in the early 70s. And in the 80s, stuff started coming out saying it has a problem explaining the returns on small stocks. It has a problem explaining the returns on high-price earning stocks. It has a problem explaining returns on high dividend price stocks. So basically anything over price, it had a problem explaining the spectrum of the returns that you observed that across that variable. And each of these was in a separate paper, and everybody said, okay, that's one problem for the CAPM, but it's still pretty good. And so what we did in 92 was we said, let's put them all together. And we looked at jointly at it, and we looked at how well beta did in describing average returns, and we basically said, this thing is fundamentally broken. Now, I didn't expect that paper to even be published, because there was nothing new in it. Every single result existed in the literature. By just putting it all together and saying, this baby's dead in the water.
This is probably the most cited paper in
It is the most cited paper in finance in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
So... that shows you how good you are in predicting which of your work is going to have an impact. So then after that, we came up in 93, we came up with a paper that was the so-called three-factor model, where we added to the CAPM market beta exposure to a size factor and exposure to a value growth factor, and that's kind of become the standard of the academic industry as well as the applied industry,
world,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, there's nothing fundamental that says there should be one factor.
No, absolutely not.
Right. So, do you view the value premium and the size premium as risk factors?
I do. So, they're both associated with covariation in returns that can't be diversified away. Now, the hard part of it is that these sources of variance seem to have different prices than market variance. Otherwise, the CAPM would work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the part that's difficult for people to grasp. But they definitely are associated with things that can't be diversified away. Now, having said that, we don't know what they are, because what you're doing is you're taking a scale price variable, book to market, say, earnings price, dividend to price. They're all something to price. So basically what you're saying is that price contains information about expected returns that isn't in the market beta. And those ratios are a good way to identify it, even though you don't know what it is.
Okay. Well, let's focus on value for a moment. Historically, value stocks have had higher returns than growth stocks, right? But we can't all buy value stocks.
No.
Right? So for everyone who invests in a value portfolio, someone else has to
go the other way, right?
Growth, right? So what's your best sense of which types of investors should be buying value and which should be tilting toward growth,
If you're a Markowitzian investor and you think variance is the only thing that counts, then you tilt heavily towards value. If you don't like to look at it, the simple way to put it is,
variance is the only thing that counts, not covariance with future consumption. Is that what you're saying?
No, right.
Yeah, okay. So that's irrational.
Yeah. That's the CAPM.
Yeah.
The CAPM says the only thing that counts, the CAPM is Markowitz.
Right.
Developed into a model of market equilibrium.
Okay.
Markowitz says you're only concerned about expected return,
covariance with
standard
the market.
Deviation of
yeah.
return. And then the CAPM says, okay, we can summarize all that with the market beta. So if you buy that story, it definitely says there are ways that you can beat that model.
Okay.
Value stocks is one way. Low beta stocks are another way. That's a result that's been known for 40 years. Small stocks, not so clear.
Okay. Because so who should be tilting toward growth and large?
People who don't. So what are the inherent characteristics of value and growth stocks? Value stocks tend to be companies that have hit bad times, to some extent, relatively speaking. Growth stocks are highly profitable on good times.
They're just expensive.
They're just expensive, right. So if you're comfortable with a portfolio where you buy all these value stocks, put them in a box, don't open the box and look at them, because you won't like what you see. It will smell badly. Then you're likely, on average, to do better. Now, part of this mutual fund study that we did, we looked for, was there any movement in the exposure of funds towards value after 1992? And what you observe is, now there are a plethora of so-called value funds. Now, some of them don't even know what that means, but there's still a plethora of them. But on the other hand, there are also many new growth funds. And if you look at the industry as a whole, it's right where it always was, nailed dead center on the market.
Well, it has to be, doesn't it?
All investment has to be.
Yeah.
So individuals, everybody has to be. But
now your firm, DFA, has not offered a growth fund, is that right?
No, nobody's asked for it. No. We would.
Isn't there someone out there who should be asking for it?
Yes, but they don't, for whatever reason, they don't come to us.
Okay.
Remember now, I use the word passive. They don't like that word, but it's based, all their products are passive. So they buy the whole bundle of small value, big value. If they were to buy growth stocks, they would buy the whole bundle of growth stocks. Now, I don't think growth stock investors like that.
Mm-hmm.
They think you should be picking among the growth stocks, the ones that are priced too low.
Yeah.
But we don't think you can do that. So.
But if there's a growth risk factor out there,
yeah.
That you know they're
there's a negative premium for growth, basically.
Right. They must be trying to hedge that, right? I mean, there should be someone trying to hedge that.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah, maybe not.
Well, if you like growth companies, you say I like growth companies, and I'll take a lower expected return.
Okay, so it's more of a consumption.
You can think of it that way. I mean, all of this can be generated by tastes towards these risk factors rather than by something having to do with covariance with consumption or anything like that.
Okay. Now, what about momentum? That came a little bit later, right? Right after value and size.
Right.
Pretty hard to argue that that's a risk factor, isn't it?
Yeah, there is covariance there. The part of it that gives me a problem is if this represents time variation in the risks of stocks, it's really discouraging because the turnover of those stocks is so high.
Yeah.
What's a momentum stock today probably isn't one 3 months from now.
Right, so, and it's not just stocks, right? It's basically pervasive in lots of assets.
Mostly in stocks, though.
Okay. But what's your take on that?
Well, you know, of all the things that I think are potential embarrassments to market efficiency, that's the primary one.
Yeah.
So, it's just a model.
So, let me ask you about behavioral finance.
Yes.
This is an area that's been growing and attracted a lot of attention recently. In the past, you've said that you've been kind of critical of it. You said it's ex post storytelling and it doesn't generate new testable hypotheses. With the development of this literature, has your view changed about that?
Well, I think they're very good at micro stuff, this individual behavior. The jumps that they make from there to markets aren't validated in the data. So they agree on the facts, for example, that there's a value premium, but they say it's irrational. So if it's irrational, it should go away. I mean, when you tell people about it, it should go away.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem to have gone away. But in any case,
what about momentum?
Momentum, you know, so there you go. They have stories that can explain momentum, and they can have stories that can explain reversal. That's too flexible, in my view. That's not a science.
Anything, huh?
No. So, you know, Kahneman's a great man, right? So I was encouraged to read his book, Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow.
Yeah, yeah.
So he says you have two brains,
right?
One is the rational, and one is the quick, impulsive, irrational. So if I tell you that that's how you can describe behavior, what can't you explain?
Well, I don't know.
Nothing. I don't think there's anything. If somebody behaves irrationally, that's one side. Somebody behaves rationally, that's the other side.
Yeah. But there's something to that, right? There is something to that.
Sure.
Yeah.
But how do you reject? What concrete?
Well, there are some papers out there, aren't there, that have sort of suggested testable hypotheses associated with
that would cause you. Well, what would they cause you to say except that? Yes, this is something people behave rationally in, or no, this is something people behave irrationally in, and my story covers both.
Okay, but let's take learning, for instance. You say if value is based on mispricing, people would learn.
That's the behavioral story,
yeah,
right.
And it would go away, right? So that's a testimony.
No, but see, what they say is it's not the way it works.
Oh.
That every generation is born stupid and stays stupid. That's the behavioral story. That's the behavioral story. People don't learn.
Well, some of it's hardwired, for sure. But then you can learn, right?
Well, for example, they say professionals are as biased as amateurs on the subjects of the professionals. They're inclined to the same sort of biases as if you went to a man on the street, that these things just did not overcome. And they never get overcome.
Yeah.
So in that case, you could expect them to persist.
We've got some questions from the audience.
Okay, great.
What's your view of the purported excess return of low volatility stocks?
Ah, that's a 50-year-old result. So it's not low volatility, it's low beta. I think that's the question. And that was well known. So originally, when the first tests of the CAPM were done, the problem that was always right out front was that the market line, the slope of the premium as a function of beta, was too low relative to what the model predicted, which meant that low beta stocks had higher returns than you would have predicted, and high beta stocks had lower returns than you would predict based on the model. And that's, for some reason, that's come back into vogue.
Right. Wasn't that Fisher Black's original idea of taking that anomaly?
Right. Well, Fisher's idea was that the problem was that the original CAPM assumed people could borrow and lend at a risk-free rate. And he said, if you throw that away, then you can't say anything about the premium except that it's positive. And so he used that, the so-called Black version of the model, basically allowed the premium to be whatever it is.
Now, next question, what happens if we all invest passively? What's going to make markets efficient if no one's invested?
Okay. So this is this. I've answered this question maybe three times a day.
Okay.
But so we've had a model. We developed a model, and it has this implication that if everything were infinitely divisible, a person with an epsilon of wealth who was informed, but insisted on not trading, had some wealth, insisted on not trading till prices conform to what he thought they should be, and he was perfectly informed. That's all you would need. An epsilon of wealth trading actively.
Very actively.
Right.
All right.
But wait a minute. Now, the other part of that question is, so what? Does that imply that you should be buying active management? Because if you do, you're going to be buying the bad ones and the good ones. You're not going to be able to tell the difference.
Yeah. No, I think it's just a question of what would happen, you know?
Yeah.
So here's the question. What do you think of the risk parity asset allocation strategy?
Never heard of it.
Okay.
What is it in my terms?
I think it's the idea that you find a bunch of different asset classes and then use leverage to get them all to the same volatility, equal risk across different asset classes.
Okay.
And Bridgewater, I think, has done this very successfully for a long time.
Okay. Stupid.
Okay.
Wait, look, if you think about your portfolio problem, you never start with a proposition like that.
Yeah.
What you're thinking about, if you're a mean variance investor, is how do I form these things to minimize variance? That would not tell you to lever them up all in the same way.
No.
That would be a result that would be so unlikely.
Right. Right. I think you'd have to have uncorrelated assets with
the same premium.
Expected return per unit of volatility
the same,
something.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would do it.
Yeah.
That's a good one. That's a good one.
Okay. All right. Let's see if I can. Okay. There's been a big expansion in central bank balance sheets associated with the bailouts.
Oh, I love this one. Right.
Yeah. Okay. What do you? Okay.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? And what?
Well, the Fed's basically made itself powerless.
Yeah.
So it wanted to. In 2008, when Lehman went down, they wanted to get the markets moving, and they thought that was going to take massive purchases on their part. But they knew that what would happen if they did that is that reserves would explode. So that's exactly what happened. Now, in the standard story, an explosion of reserves is an explosion in the price level, except if you go and pay interest on reserves. And that's what they did. So they came in and they paid interest on reserves. But what that implies is that if they ever had any power, they lost it at that point, because now all they're doing is issuing bonds to buy bonds. So it's a neutral activity. And that's the game they're in now. Now, what I don't want to get too technical here, but what that implies is that the price level is indeterminate.
That's probably not a good thing. Huh?
No, probably not a good thing. Because why is that true? It's because banks are free to exchange currency for reserves on demand. The Fed has to accommodate them. Now, in the old story, it was the monetary base that determined inflation. If you pay full interest on reserves, it's the currency supply that determines inflation. If you don't control the currency supply, which they can't, then inflation becomes indeterminate.
How does that relate to the debt issues that we're facing?
The debt issues are really entirely different, I think. The debt issues are, how much do you sacrifice the future for the present, and do you get anything in the present out of the future that you're sacrificing? This has been the big debate among the Keynesians versus the the other people since 2000.
But aren't they related in that one way out of the debt is to inflate it away?
Well, sure. Now, one way out of what you would do, if you stop paying interest on reserves, you got a big problem in terms of inflation. That will get rid of the debt, but it may get rid of the country. I mean, so can you think of it now? The monetary base was about $150 billion before the Fed stepped in. I think required reserves are still about in that neighborhood. They're holding $2.5 trillion worth. So if you say, okay, the price of it is going to expand by the ratio of those two numbers, you have a hyperinflation on your hands. Economies don't typically do well in hyperinflations. The government debt disappears, but the economy disappears with it.
So how would you change either monetary or fiscal policy at this point?
Simple. So you could balance the budget. I heard somebody say this. I won't mention their name because they said it in private, but a very prominent person. You could balance the budget by going back to expenditures in 2007. The economy is about the size now that it was then. If you just rolled expenditures back to that point, you'd balance the budget. Now, what is it that we've picked up in that time that is so bloody important? Dick Roll says, why go back to 2007? How about 1887? But in any case, nobody is willing to do that.
Going forward, are there particular areas of research that either you're focused on or you think the industry is that look to be exciting to you right now?
Well, see, that's a question you get all the time. And I don't know if other people know what's going to be exciting. I've never been able to do it. And I think that's the fundamental excitement about academics. You don't know what's going to surprise you next year, even next week, or what's going to turn things on their heads. So I have no predictions in that respect.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr.
My pleasure.
Palma.
Copyright 2012 CFA Institute. This program is designed to give accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is distributed with the understanding that CFA Institute is not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, investment, or other expert advice. If legal advice or other expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional should be sought.